So, in my last message, we explored individualism, the movement of individualism that is in our society today. We noted that individualism is a philosophy that views people first as individual units rather than members of a group. It emphasizes the importance of independence and autonomy. And emerging from the idea of individualism is the idea of expressive individualism. It focuses on the idea that the whole point of a person's existence is to be authentic. That for individuals to be authentic, they must align their life with their deepest desires. And for societies to be authentic, they must support and even applaud this behavior. And some of the phrases we may be familiar with that talk about this, that reflect this philosophy, are be true to yourself, follow your heart, find yourself. And expressive individualism has outcomes in our society, such as the rise of victimhood, a prioritization of individual rights over responsibilities, over duty and care for others. In the message, we took a look at what society would be like as time moves on, as we move towards the return of Jesus Christ. 2 Timothy 3, 1-4, and I'll read from the New Life Version. And for those who are guests, when I'm not reading from the New King James, I put the scripture on the screen. And it states, "You must understand that in the last days there will come times of much trouble. People will love themselves and money. They will have pride and tell of all the things they have done. They will speak against God. Children and young people will not obey their parents. People will not be thankful. They will not be holy. They will tell lies about others. They will not love each other. No one can get along with them. They will tell lies about others. They will not be able to keep from doing the things that they should not do. They will be wild and want to beat and hurt those who are good. They will not stay true to their friends. They will act without thinking. They will think too much of themselves. They will love fun instead of loving God." And in the message, we compared individualism with individuality. Individuality refers to the characteristics that makes each and every person unique, and refers only to one person. In the biblical context, we understand that we are all, young and old, uniquely made. Our relationship with God is personal, yet we're part of a community, a greater community, a body, where we grow together in grace and knowledge and helping each other along the way with the gifts and the talents we've all been blessed with. As I conclude the brief summary of the previous message, I want to review a piece that I brought up in the message from Trevin Wax entitled "Expressive Individualism. What is it?" Where he quotes the Australian church leader Mark Sayers of noting 7 different beliefs of an expressive individualistic society. The point I would like us to consider, and the point of this message we're going to, is point number 4. And with number 4 is as follows. The primary social ethic is tolerance of everyone's self-defined quest for individual freedom and self-expression. Any deviation from this ethic of tolerance is dangerous and must not be tolerated. Therefore, social justice is less about economic or class inequality and more about the issues of equality relating to individual identity, self-expression, and personal autonomy. Today, I would liken this message to expand upon this 4th point that Mark Sayers brings up, that within expressive individualism, tolerance is not to be tolerated. Now, tolerance is an interesting word. The definition in our society, it has changed. The society has changed the definition over time. So let's take a look at what the Oxford Languages says the definition of tolerance is. The ability or willingness to tolerate something, in particular, the existence of opinions or behavior that one does not necessarily agree with. When I look at synonyms for tolerance, we can see words such as patience, forbearance, willingness. They're all assigned to the dictionary definition of tolerance. However, tolerance and the meaning of tolerance is morphing to something different. To tolerate someone today means not only to bear the individual with patience and respect, but it goes further in requiring us to affirm, to accept, and even celebrate values and choices, even when they don't reconcile with our beliefs. In today's definition of tolerance, everybody's beliefs are equal. Perceptions and claims of truth are equal. Effectively, nobody's wrong. Everybody's right. The terms equated with the philosophical movement of today, of tolerance today, are relativism and postmodernism. Let's take a brief look at the words that relate to these and definitions that relate to these words. Vocabulary.com defines relativism as the belief that there's no absolute truth, only the truths that a particular individual or culture happen to believe. If you believe in relativism, then you think different people can have different views about what's moral and what's immoral. Relativism is the philosophy that individual beliefs, lifestyle, and perception of truth are equal. Your beliefs and my beliefs are equal, and all truth is relative. In an August 24th article from Josh Moody in the Gospel Coalition entitled, Does the Bible Promote Tolerance or Intolerance? Provides some additional thoughts on relativism. The idea that all truth is only relatively true, depending on your perspective, upbringing, and personality, is practically a universal doctrine of our secular age. Many think relativism prevents people from judging each other and therefore prevents intolerance. This is ironic because few doctrines have proved more intolerant than the doctrine that everything is relative. Now let's take briefly a look at postmodernism. PBS.org defines postmodernism as follows: a general and wide-ranging term which applied to literature, art, philosophy, architecture, fiction, and cultural and literary criticism, among others. Postmodernism is largely a reaction to the assumed certainty of scientific or objective efforts to explain reality. In essence, it stems from a recognition that reality is not simply mirrored in human understanding of it, but rather it is constructed as the mind tries to understand its own particular or personal reality. For this reason, postmodernism is highly skeptical of explanations which claim to be valid for all groups, cultures, traditions, or races, and instead focuses on the relative truths of each person. Postmodern society basically states there is no real truth. It says knowledge is either invented or not discovered. And because knowledge is effectively made by people, a person cannot know something for sure. That all ideas and facts are believed rather than known. Relativism, postmodernism, as we reviewed in my last message, expressive individualism is the background of what's happening in today's society. The confusion, the turmoil, the spiraling moral decay that we see in our society today. But there's also one other factor I would like us to consider, and this one is more of an internal factor. Expressive individualism, relativism, and postmodernism are external pressures. But there's an internal pressure we must be aware of as we face attacks on values, and that is spiritual arrogance. It's not uncommon today for people to boast in their ability to tolerate sin. People are effectively proud of the way that they may accept things and participate in things that the Bible warns of. In a way, a person who is spiritually arrogant believes they know better. They are more enlightened. And the church in Corinth had the same attitude. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1. And I'll read from the ESV if you'd like to follow along. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1. It states in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1, it is actually reported that there's sexual immorality among you, and the kind that's not even tolerated, even among the pagans. For a man has taken his father's wife, and you are arrogant. Ought you not rather mourn? Let him who has done this be removed from you. Ancient Corinth had a reputation for immorality and decadence. The Christian History Institute notes that the Greeks had a name for everything, and they termed the term Corinthazestai to mean immorality, literally to live a Corinthian life. The Corinthians, in their pride, their arrogance, made themselves insensitive to sin, which was not even tolerated among the pagans of the day. And I would believe that many in society want to view themselves as tolerant. But this, by thinking this, they may actually accept that they can actually accept people without passing judgment on any action or lifestyle choice. But is that what the Bible says? And that leads me to the title of this message. Was Jesus tolerant? What about us? Before I begin, I want to address the idea that people should tolerate anything. It's not possible. It's not even reasonable. For example, should we tolerate sepsis in an operating room? Should perjury be tolerated in a court of law? Should people be tolerated just to go through red lights when they want? Many think you would think these examples are a bit obvious, and I only bring them to make a point. Not everything is tolerated in this society. There are laws. There are rules that dictate behavior to a properly functioning society. In considering tolerance, we Christians, we of the family of God, have a standard. It's not ruled by expressive individualism, postmodernism, or relativism, but it's found in Acts 5, verse 29, where Peter was brought before the Sanhedrin. And let's start in verse 26, if we would turn there. Acts 5, verse 29. Since it's the New King James Version, I won't put it up on the screen. If we would turn there. Acts 5, verse 29. It states in verse 26, we'll begin. Then the captain went with the officers and brought them without violence, for they feared the people, lest they should be stoned. And when they had brought them, they set them before the council. And the high priest asked them, saying, do we not strictly command you not to teach in his name? And look, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood on us. Verse 29 I will put on the screen because this is our standard. But Peter and the other apostles answered and said, We ought to obey God rather than men. As we see in society around us, there is a conflict. Some in society are espousing thoughts, ideas, actions that are contrary to what God sets as a standard. And as time goes on, we are seeing less and less tolerance towards God's way of life by certain, sometimes vocal, members of society. Christians are painted with the terms such as intolerant, bigoted, and worse. So was Jesus tolerant? Let's see examples where Jesus engaged in this a variety of people and society. Let's turn to Mark 2, verse 16. Please turn to Mark 2, verse 16. Mark 2, verse 16. And it states in Mark 2, verse 16, "And when the scribes and Pharisees saw him eating with the tax collectors and sinners, they said to his disciples, 'How is it that he eats and drinks with tax collectors and sinners?'" Jesus spent time with sinners. And maybe even more telling, sinners spent time with him. Matthew 9, verse 10. Matthew 9, verse 10. Let's turn, if we could turn there. Matthew 9, verse 10. Matthew 9, verse 10, says, "As Jesus reclined at the table of the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And the Pharisees saw this, and they said to his disciples, 'Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?'" Jesus Christ was accused of being friends of sinners. This was effectively the word on the street in first century Palestine. And we can see this. Let's turn to Matthew 11, verse 9. And I'll read from the English Standard Version. Matthew 11, verse 9. It states, "For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, 'He is a demon.' The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, 'Look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is justified by her deeds.'" So did Jesus effectively just hang around with tax collectors or sinners? Or was there more to the story? Let's consider where a woman was brought before Jesus because she had committed adultery. And that's John chapter 8, verse 4. If we would turn there to John chapter 8, verse 4. I'll read through verse 11 through the New Living Translation, if you would like to follow along. John chapter 8, verse 4. It said, "Teacher," they said to Jesus, "this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say?" They were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him, but Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his fingers. They kept demanding an answer, so he stood up again and said, "All right. Let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." And he stooped down again and wrote in the dust. Verse 9. When accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest, until only Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Then Jesus stood up again and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you?" "No, Lord," she said, and Jesus said, "Neither do I." We see that Christ dealt kindly with the woman in adultery. But did he condone what she had done? Was he tolerant of the adultery that was committed? No. Though he was kind, though he was compassionate to the woman, he concluded verse 11 by saying, "Go and sin no more." There was also the healing of a lame person at the pool of Bethesda, where Jesus told the man, "Stop sinning, or something else something worse may happen to you in John 5, verse 14. In both cases, Jesus was warning against the return to sinful lifestyle choices. He extended mercy, but he also demanded a change. Indeed, there is no tolerance of sin with God. Let's turn to Isaiah 1, verse 16. Isaiah 1, verse 16. And this I will put on the screen. Isaiah 1, verse 16. Well, actually, I didn't put it on the screen. Sorry about that. Misread my notes. Isaiah 1, verse 16 to 17. Wash yourselves, make yourself clean. Put away the evil of your doings before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Rebuke the oppressor. Defend the fatherless. Plead for the widow. Yes, Jesus spent time with sinners. He spent time with the oppressed. He spent time with the lost. But he did so with a purpose. Let's turn to Luke 4, verse 17 through 19. We'll read to verse 19. Luke 4, 17. Luke 4, verse 17. And this is where Jesus quotes Isaiah 61, 1 to 2. And in verse 17 it says, and he handed the book of the prophet, and he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty all of those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. What about us? In many ways, the social and political conditions of our society today parallel the days of the New Testament. The Roman Empire was marked by religious diversity and sexual license, and the Christians of that day had to deal with those issues, as do we. We could hide from it. We could hide ourselves from it, effectively becoming hermits. But that is not our calling. Our calling is to be a light to the world. Matthew 5, verse 14. Ambassadors for Christ. 2 Corinthians 5, 20. A chosen race. A royal priesthood. A holy nation. A people for his own possession. 1 Peter 2, verse 9. This is our walk. Our interaction is with those in the world, as an ambassador for Christ, as lights to a world, to a lost world. We are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possessions, engaged in living in this world. Christ prayed before his death that he asked the fathers that those who he would call would not be taken out of this world, but kept from the evil one. How engaged are we with others? Let's turn to 1 Peter 3, verse 14. 1 Peter 3, verse 14, and I'd like to read from the New Living Translation. How engaged are we with others? 1 Peter 3, verse 14, and it states, but even as you suffer for doing what is right, God will reward you for it. So don't worry or be afraid of their threats. Instead, you must worship Christ as the Lord of your life. And if someone asks you about your hope as a believer, always be ready to explain it. But do this in a gentle and respectful way. Keep your conscience clear. Then if people speak against you, they will be ashamed when they see what a good life you live because you belong to Christ. Let's also go to 2 Timothy 2, verse 24. 2 Timothy 2, verse 24, how engaged are we to be with others? 2 Timothy 2, 24 to 25, and again, I'll read from the New Living Translation. A servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but must be kind to everyone. Be able to teach. Be patient with difficult people. Gently instruct those who oppose the truth. Perhaps God will change those people's hearts, and they will learn the truth. 1 Peter 3, verse 15. 1 Peter 3, verse 15. Now I'll read from the English Standard Version. But in your hearts, honor Christ as holy, always being prepared to make a defense for anyone who asks you for a reason of the hope that's within you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect. A quote with regard to our outlook on this matter is as follows. Biblical tolerance is based on seeing others as lost. They deserve our compassion. When you look at people this way, you can listen to them and you can treat them with openness and respect, even though you disagree with them. Biblical tolerance also allows you to share the truth with gentleness. And that was from Larry Fowler of Focus on the Family. And what does God say he will do in those situations when we are interacting with others, when others ask us of the hope that's within us, or others challenge us for what we believe? What did God say he would do? Let's turn to Isaiah 51, verse 15. I will read from the New Century Version. Isaiah 51, verse 15. And it states in Isaiah 51, verse 15, I am the Lord your God who stirs the sea and makes the waves roar. My name is Lord, all-powerful. I will give you the words I want you to say. I will cover you with my hands and protect you. I made the heavens and the earth, and I say to Jerusalem, you are my people. God will give us the words. But in order for that to happen, we need to be connected to God, to know his mind, to know his way of life. We need to talk with him. Converse with him. Walk with God. And this doesn't mean the journey will be easy. To stand up for God in this day of expressive individualism, relativism, and postmodernism is not easy. You'll be called names. The situation we find ourselves in is analogous to the city of Thyatira, which is found in the book of Revelation. And as background, the city was founded 3 centuries before the time of Christ, and the small city became a major commercial center and economy for the area. It was situated between Pergamos and Sardis, and the residents became very wealthy, like people of other cities, and then built temples to pagan gods. Now, Thyatira was noted for the trade guilds, and it was probably the city was more organized than any other ancient city because of them. Powerful among the trade guilds at the time were the coppersmiths, and the other was the Guild of Dyers. A member of this guild seems to be Lydia of Thyatira, which is mentioned in Acts 16, verse 14. So let's go to Revelation 2, verses 18 to 20, and I'd like to read from the English Standard Version, where God talks to the church in Thyatira. And to the angel of the church in Thyatira write, these are the words of the Son of God, who has eyes like a flame of fire and whose feet are like burnished bronze. I know your works, your love and faith and service and patient endurance, and your latter work exceeds the first. It would appear that the church in Thyatira was a compassionate church. They reached out to assist the poor. If a person didn't belong to a trade union, they found it difficult to provide for their family. And fortunately, there's those in the church that would help those who are less fortunate. The church also exhibited patience in the face of difficult circumstances. Persecution must have been incredibly strong in idolatrous Thyatira, where trade unions held banquets, which their members ate food dedicated to idols. And refusal to participate would undoubtedly mark Christians for persecution, not to mention impacting their businesses. Nonetheless, Thyatira exhibited love, faith, service, and patient endurance. But against this backdrop, it is noted that Christ had something against them. It's that they tolerated Jezebel. Verse 20. But I have this against you, that you tolerate the woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, and is teaching and seducing my servants to practice sexual immorality and to eat food sacrificed to idols. Now, Jezebel's story is found in 1 and 2 Kings. She was the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of Tyre and Sidon, and priest of the cult of Baal, a false god whose worship involved sexual degradation and lewdness. When she became queen, she married King Ahab of Israel, and she began a relentless campaign to rid Israel of all evidence of worship of God. She ordered the exterminations of all the prophets of the Lord and was challenged by Elijah the prophet, who demanded a contest on Mount Carmel between the powers of Israel's God and the power of Jezebel and the priest of Baal. So famous was Jezebel's sexual immorality and idol worship that she's referenced in Revelation in the warning to the church at Thyatira. Whether the Jezebel mentioned at Thyatira is a real person or a metaphor is unclear. What is clear is that the church tolerated her influence. Later verses show that Jezebel and all followers would be punished by God. This leads to a question. What influences found in our society do we tolerate? Only we can answer that. But how do we avoid becoming tolerant of what's happening in society today? The loss of morality, the attack on the family unit, the hatred, the divisions, the exploitation of children, man's inhumanity to man. Of course, it's living a relationship with God, with prayer, and with study, and striving to live God's way of life every day, walking with God daily. But we also need to do more, and we need to be more painfully aware of what's going on. We're not to be indifferent to what's going on in the world around us. We're not to be arrogant. Not to be tolerant is defined by this day and age. We need to see the world for what it is, and it should emotionally impact us. Ezekiel 9. The English Standard Version. Then he cried in my ears with a loud voice, saying, bring near the executioner of the city, each with a destroying weapon in his hand. Verse 2. And behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his weapon for slaughter in his hand. And with them was a man clothed in linen with a writing case at his waist. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. Now the glory of God of Israel had gone up from the cherub which had rested to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed in linen who had the writing case at his waist. And the Lord said to him, pass through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed in it. And later it notes that those who did not have the mark should be destroyed. Chapter 9 of Ezekiel reveals some insight about God sparing a remnant during a time of destruction. It talks about punishment that's to come onto Israel and Judah in verse 9. As the northern kingdom of Israel had fallen more than a century before Ezekiel wrote, this prophecy is considered for the future Israel and Judah. And as in chapters 4 to 7, Jerusalem here is used to represent all Israel, the city being an ancient capital of the 12 tribes. Of course, the prophecy had only limited application of Judah in Ezekiel's own day, but it also relates to a time of the future. What should the people here be doing? While they should be sighing and crying. Sigh in the Hebrew word anak means to groan, to mourn, and to sigh. Cry in the Hebrew word is anak means to cry and to groan. Sigh implies inward grief. Cry, the outward expression of it. Cry, or the Hebrew anak, is only used 4 times in scriptures. The word contains a great deal of emotional meaning. It involves a person's most innermost feelings. The writer with the case, or Incarn in the New King James Version, in Ezekiel 9:3, is instructed to mark the foreheads of those who sigh and cry over the abomination and the idolatry that's around them. The sign here is not just disappointment. It's a groaning of the spirit. It's deeply grieving and feeling anguish over what's happening. Matthew Henry makes the following commentary about sighing and crying. Now observe the distinguishing character of this remnant that is to be saved. They are such as sigh and cry, sigh in themselves as the men in pain and distress, and cry to God in prayer as men in earnest, because of all the abominations that are committed in Jerusalem. It was not only the idolatries they were guilty of, but the other enormities that were abominations to God. These pious few had witnessed against those abominations and had done what they could in their places to suppress them. But finding all their attempts for the reformation of manners fruitless, they sat down, sighed and cried, wept in secret, and complained to God. Because of the dishonor done to his name by their wickedness and the ruin it was bringing upon the church and the nation. Note, it is not enough that we do not delight in the sins of others and that we don't have fellowship with them, but we must mourn for them, lay them to the heart, and we must grieve for that which we cannot help. And for those who hate sin for their own sake and have a tender concern for the souls of others. Matthew Henry notices there's 2 reasons why people were to sigh and cry at what was going on in the world around them. Idolatry and all the other enormities, or the other actions of man that was causing pain and suffering in the world. The wars, the diseases, the immorality, the divisions, the hatred, the pain. The point is here, we must not become indifferent. We must not become tolerant of what is going on in society today, that we're no longer fazed by it. The divisions, the hatred, the confusion, the abuse. We must not be so jaundiced by sin around us that we no longer sigh and cry for the world. In this message, we reviewed philosophies that were making an impact on our society today. Expressive individualism, relativism, and postmodernism, and how the word tolerance is effectively being changed in its meaning, that everybody's beliefs are equal, perceptions of claims relating to truth are equal, and effectively nobody's wrong and everybody's right. In fact, what is being noticed is that society is becoming more intolerant to those who do not embrace this philosophy. We need to be careful that we don't find ourselves becoming spiritually arrogant as the church in Corinth. We also saw that through Jesus Christ, that though he interacted with all, he did so with a purpose. He did not tolerate sin. What he did was reflected in his reading of Isaiah 61, to preach the gospel to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, to give sight to the blind. With regard to us, our walk, our interaction with others, we are ambassadors of Christ, a light to the world, a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. As Jesus, we are not to tolerate sin, to become so indifferent to it that we lose our journey as members of God's family. Nonetheless, we are to engage those we interact with by being kind, respectful, gentle, willing to share the hope that lies within us when we are asked. Isaiah 61 notes that God will give us the words to say in those situations. In this message, we also saw the warning to the church at Thyatira that they exhibited love, faith, service, and patient endurance, yet they tolerated Jezebel. And finally, we examined the prophecy in Ezekiel and the need not to become indifferent or tolerant of the abominations and sufferings that are going on in the world. We understand that all are made in the image of God, that all have an opportunity for salvation, and they're lost at this time. And we sigh and cry over the suffering that is going on for all those who are lost. So to close, I would like us to consider two questions. Was Jesus Christ tolerant? What about us? Looking forward to seeing everybody after services.